Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. Today's episode is about sex, so it may not be suitable for everybody. A bunch of giggling teenagers are checking out toys of the adult variety. I'm at Sexploratorium, that's a boutique dedicated to all things sex in Philadelphia, and I'm meeting up with Timory Schmidt.
Hey, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Timory is a sexuality educator. She teaches classes here occasionally. She also hosts a podcast about sex. And she's giving me a tour. There's a whole shelf with leather masks.
Oh, yeah. So these are for, like, puppy play. You could have, like, a set of ears and a muzzle and all that.
Okay. Little cat ears. Cute. I like those. Little tails.
Of course, there are vibrators. Lots of them in all colors, all shapes and sizes.
It goes a little bit more intense. I don't know. And if you want to feel what it feels like, I always recommend trying it on the tip of your nose.
Timory is having all a blast, and I'm feeling a little weird being here.
So what would you say to somebody like me who is like in this store and I'm kind of like, yeah, I don't know if I want to be here?
Well, you don't have to. You don't have to be in anything. That's the nice thing, is that sexual freedom includes the possibility that it's not of interest. I would just ask any person who comes in here, like, what are you interested in? What sparks joy? what sparks your curiosity?
She says lots of us have different hang-ups, things that get in the way of fully exploring our sexuality.
We get messages that sexuality is dirty and sinful and that it is inappropriate to even explore your own body, much less to ask questions and explore the world.
She says this place is about having fun.
This is a toy store. It's just an adult toy store.
And sex is tied to our well-being and health.
What is more enlivening than, I think, connecting with other people, feeling exhilarated, feeling excited, experimenting, doing things that you don't necessarily know how this is gonna go. Sexuality is an opportunity for creative expression.
At its best, sex releases endorphins, makes you happy, feel at home in your body. But unsafe sex can make you sick. And so many things can get in the way of enjoying sex: illnesses, trauma, aging. On today's episode, we're going to explore the different connections between sex and our health and some of the barriers that prevent people from having the sex life they want. There's always a risk with sex. It can expose you to diseases, and let's face it, that thought puts a major damper on things. These days, a lot of people take PrEP to cut down specifically on the risk of HIV. PrEP stands for pre-exposure prophylaxis. You take one pill a day to prevent HIV infection, and even if you're opting out of condoms, it reduces the risk of contracting the disease by more than 90%. So PrEP is here, it works, but getting your hands on it can be a different story. Some healthcare providers don't know that much about it, and access can also be harder depending on where you live. Alexander Charles Adams lives in Louisiana, where getting a PrEP prescription was a challenge. Alexander recalls the experience.
I started hearing Ask Your Doctor About PrEP on TV and YouTube sometime in spring of 2016. I was a university student having their fair share of queer fun, so PrEP was definitely a topic of conversation. But when I Googled it, a big $1,200 per month price tag came up, which made me terrified to ask my parents about it, and they pay for my health insurance. Then, a long list of confusing side effects nausea, filled
vomiting,
my computer screen.
Stomach pain, diarrhea, headache, dizziness.
Here's the deal. I don't like condoms. The feel, the idea, the whole thing. At the same time, I was truly lucky to receive a comprehensive sexual health education. So I couldn't rationalize having the sex I wanted to have and not protecting myself from a threat I well knew was there. alone in my bedroom, just coming off of the last of a series of HIV scares, I was determined. I was going to get on PrEP and stop this anxiety, this self-hatred for my sex life. So come hell or high water, I picked up the phone, called my family doctor, and made an appointment. I get in, play on my phone to calm down, ignore the weird Christian rock playing from the intercom, and prepare to talk to this old straight white man about sex things. He comes in, I breathe, and then I give my pitch.
So, I'm high risk, and I know that. I had 82 partners last year. I'm using but hating condoms. And I know that there's another way to do this. Could we look at Truvada for PrEP?
He pulls his laptop in front of him, does some click-clack-clacking away, and then come the words.
This isn't covered by your insurance.
No, without insurance, I can't do this.
I can't afford this.
I can't ask my dad.
I can't.
No.
I go home searching for another option, Googling furiously. And I find out what my doc said wasn't true.
Wait, what?
Not only did my insurance cover it, Gilead, the manufacturer, had a copay program that made the pills free, regardless of where you get them from or if you have insurance.
Why would my doctor lie to me? Maybe he didn't know.
So I go back to my doc to demand an explanation. He comes in. I blurt out,
I need PrEP. I promise I'm going to show up for blood work, and I promise I will tell you if I have side effects, but I need this medication. Please.
What he says next still messes with me today.
I will not prescribe a slut drug. I do not want to talk about this again.
That should never have happened. But I only know that now. In 2016, PrEP was easily accessible in so many gay capitals across the country with payment help, free lab costs, and community engagement. But San Francisco is San Francisco. Southeast Louisiana is something else. Recently, I talked it out with a friend of mine, Austin Matthews. He's a social worker in the HIV care scene here in Louisiana.
It's very rare that clients come in and they're just so forthright with you about saying, I know that I have some behavior that put me in a higher category for this outcome. Please help me. Like that's, if I could hear that from every client that I've ever seen as a social worker, my life would be so much easier. The doctor, you gave the doctor a win.
But that doesn't really answer my question. So I talk to someone else who helps people get on this medication every day. I share the same story again, this time with nurse practitioner Dion Bell.
You know, it's unfortunate, but that happens a lot. You know, down here in the South, you know, it's a little different. You know, all over the country, people are evolving and trying to eliminate HIV, and this is just one of the steps in that goal. I understand discomfort with something that you don't know. I totally get that. I do feel that he could have at least helped you to find a resource to get on PrEP.
But he didn't. I'm 19, trying to stay safe, and staring at Say Nothing billboards with no real resources on them. Just, did you know that there's a pill that can prevent HIV? Yeah, girl, I do, but that doesn't mean I know how to get it.
I've seen the commercials, I've seen the billboards, I've seen the signs, but there's still, you know, more we need to do as far as getting access and word out there to people that this is what we have and this is available to you.
Soon the new year rolled in, and in 2017, while I was trying my best to adhere to my sex light diet and get on this medication, something was changing in my backyard.
Baton Rouge has the highest incident rate of people living with HIV, as well as people who have a confirmed AIDS diagnosis within 1 year of being diagnosed with HIV.
Okay, see? Then I couldn't be the only person who needs this. I mean, I'm not some reckless maniac. Yes, sex was my risk factor, but it's also what ended up protecting me. One night at 3 a.m., I got a series of attractive images on Grindr, this hookup app, and decided to go over to this guy's house. just a run-of-the-mill meetup for me. When I asked him about his HIV status, he said,
"Negative and on PrEP. Yourself?"
I turned the conversation to how hard it had been for me to get a prescription. His face lit up. He grabbed his computer and he said,
"I can help. PrEP is actually my job."
And I stood there in shock and awe. He pulled up this map I had never seen before where I could put in my zip code and find a clinic that offered PrEP specifically. This clinic finder was new and my head exploded. My friend Austin wasn't surprised that this information came to me during a rendezvous.
People who are on PrEP need to be having talks with their sex partners. Why aren't you on PrEP? Because, real talk, if I'm on PrEP and I'm having sex with someone, that does not protect them from anything. But honestly, once you know what people are into, you can have better sexual relationships.
I mean, I think that's true. That's a very true sentence.
Like, that is, like, let me social work everyone over the radio for just a moment. That when you know what people are into, when you know their background, when you know what's up and what's not, you can have much better, happier, healthier sex life.
I get home, plug in my zip code, and call the nearest clinic. Hi, I'd like to make a PrEP appointment. It's my first time, yes. Only Wednesdays, between 1 and 6. I'm sorry, I have to work. I have to. Let me call you back later. Hi, I called yesterday about a PrEP appointment. Alexander Adams? Yeah. 4 weeks? I'm sorry. Okay. I drive down to the clinic on my one day off to do the new patient rigmarole, and I meet my PrEP navigator. This is the moment. I answer some intake questions, confirm my insurance, and then I am shown the door.
It'll be another week before we do an HIV test. Then 2 weeks after that, we'll do another one, and then you'll get your prescription.
What?
There are necessary delays in the PrEP process because we don't want to prescribe you a medication that's not right for you.
Okay, that's fair. But all in all, getting on PrEP took the better part of a year. The process was convoluted, bureaucratic, and degrading. But I made it. At any point in that journey, if one night didn't go as planned, if one guy persuaded me past my boundaries, if any fiber of my will to avoid HIV had faltered for one moment, I would have become positive. And this story would be very different. PrEP changed my life. I say this for two reasons, because I'm without a doubt high risk. Like, honey. But more importantly, I felt more secure. I respected more people's kinks and interests, and I could even begin to explore my own.
That was sound artist Alexander Charles Adams telling the story of getting on PrEP. You're listening to The Pulse. We're talking about sex and our health. How we enjoy sex, how comfortable we feel, can change over the course of our lives.
My sex life is the best it's ever been. I'm 70. I'm Dr. Susanna Mayer, clinical sexologist, and my specialty is libido and arousal. I don't get turned on necessarily by the sight of my lover anymore. I need much more than that stimulation. Pretty much it's the same for him. And so we're dealing with different bodies. I'm dealing with two new hips, lower back issues. In bed, it becomes sometimes a joke and you have to laugh about it. You know, I used to be a dancer decades ago, and so in bed I could literally dance. And if somebody saw me now, they'd go, "Oh my goodness, you know, she's barely moving and it's struggling and all that stuff." But you do have to laugh at it, because otherwise you'd probably cry over it, and that wouldn't be a great turn on. What I have found for me, my slice of heaven in all this sex play, is just, you know, after my lover has been pleasured and I ask, just lying in his arms while I'm giving myself an orgasm. You know, that is just heaven for me. It's wonderful. I lost my sex drive sometime during postmenopause, after I had gone through official menopause. It was tough, you know. So I started reading, you know, my erotica books and looking at sexually explicit films and getting turned on by those. And for me at this point, it's not just about the act of having sex. It's about the wanting of sex. I realized the connection that I have with somebody else in terms of expressing myself sexually, it's not something I'm going to just do when I walk in the door and see him. It's part of an erotic connection. We text each other and we turn each other on, not necessarily with huge, you know, erotic stories per se, but just a few words, because what I have found out for me, it's feeling wanted. That is a real turn on when somebody wants you.
Susanna Mayer is the author of Does Sex Have an Expiration Date? Not everybody is as comfortable discussing or talking about sex or even spelling out what they like or don't like. Ginger Manley is a retired sex therapist and a nurse practitioner. She says the biggest reason people struggle around sexuality is that they don't know how to talk about it.
I say to people, the most important thing you can do is have true oral sex. And that doesn't mean genitals to mouth. It means using your mouth and your ears to talk about this, fully clothed or maybe not clothed, but to talk about it.
When she was younger, Ginger didn't think too much about people in their 60s and 70s having sex.
Because that was like just more information than I want. But I found that there's a whole world of sexual issues that people never have gotten answers for and would like to have help with.
So she started to write a sex advice column in a Tennessee magazine called Mature Lifestyles. Ginger called it Assisted Loving. Readers around Nashville sent her questions, and she provided answers, Dear Abby style.
I actually was banned because a group of people approached my publisher and said, this is the filthiest, nastiest stuff.
But Ginger persisted. The column went on, and she answered questions like, is kissing still in fashion? What do I do when my overactive bladder spoils love feelings? Or how to navigate physical challenges with intimacy after a major surgery?
Virtually every illness or every disease or every surgery can affect our sexuality because it affects our ability to move, or to respond, all of those kinds of things. But particularly with hip surgery, with knee surgery, you get a new joint and you don't want to mess anything up. So there really are some guidelines for the things that you can and cannot do after that. For instance, a woman who's had hip replacement surgery needs to be careful that she not get into a position where she could possibly get her hip out of joint again. And then there's the whole issue about what happens when one partner develops dementia. And I think that it's extremely difficult because if the mate is in a caregiver role, it's very hard to feel sexually attracted toward the other person. And I saw a lot of the people that I worked with over time who felt very lonely and very isolated because they were in that role. So every illness and every surgery can affect a person's sexual functioning and their joyfulness.
Ginger says as you get older, your sex life might need a little help.
It's a much more hands-on experience than sex was perhaps when they were younger, when biology was totally in charge. Biology is still there, but it needs a whole lot of help. Sometimes people are very reticent to engage in full-body sexual touching with their hands, with many other parts of their body. So I encourage them to use that assistance, to use oils and getting a medical evaluation. If a person needs to be on assistance with one of the drugs like Viagra, many women need to be on some kind of estrogen if their bodies and their health will allow it, to keep the vagina flexible and plastic so that it moves and you don't get injured. I think people might need to use some kind of sexual toy because it requires more stimulation. And the kind of stimulation that an older person requires is much more than a younger person would require.
Ginger says talking, listening, taking some risks, and being open with your partner can lead to new sexual experiences and intimacy, even as we age. She told me about a letter she received from one of her readers.
Dear Ginger, I'm in my 80s. I've just celebrated my first year wedding anniversary. We were both happily married for many decades before our spouses died, and neither of us ever thought we would marry again. But miracles do happen. While sex is different in this stage of life, it is good.
Ginger Manley is a retired sex therapist. Her book is called Assisted Loving: The Journey Through Sexuality and Aging. One of the most common sexual activities is performed alone, masturbation. These days, many people talk about it openly, view it as healthy, but masturbation used to be a very hush-hush topic, and there were warnings about doing it too much. You'll go blind or you'll grow hair on your palms and knuckles. A new generation of men is giving up masturbation, or trying to, for different reasons. Jad Slayman looked into this.
Pull up the Reddit page for a community called NoFap. You'll notice each user has a statistic by their screen name.
8 days.
21 days.
77
days. 320
days. 814 days.
That's how long they've gone without masturbating. FAP is an onomatopoeia, a word that sounds like what it describes, like, you know, buzz or pop. NoFAP means abstaining for long periods of time. It's something adherents call a reboot. The practice is rooted in a response to internet pornography, which NoFappers consider highly addictive. The guy who coined the term NoFap is a former software analyst, Alexander Rhodes. He spoke with WBUR in Boston a few years ago about his struggle with porn and masturbation.
I felt completely powerless. I was in a very low point of life. I was just questioning, why am I so lethargic? Why do I feel like I can't stop doing this?
He's building a Pittsburgh-based business around what he calls porn recovery and said he's too busy to sit down for an interview. But the whole idea of NoFap has grown way beyond his answer to internet porn. The subreddit he started in 2011 now has 410,000 subscribers. While he talks about laying off for a few months, others online boast about years without masturbation. Some claim abstaining can completely change you, make you more confident with women, better at the gym. I talked to someone who's trying this out, Daniel Nadim. He's a 20-something Canadian who promotes the practice online. His brother introduced him to NoFap.
He actually pulled out his phone and it was like 30-something days. I'm like, what is that? What are you showing me? He's like, these are the amount of days I haven't watched porn or masturbated for.
Daniel thought it was dumb at first, but he says his life wasn't going so well at the time. He's always been anxious and lonely. Things were especially bad in high school, and he used masturbation to cope.
I remember this one instance where I bombed a test, and I was so mad, and I just went home and spent the entire day just watching pornography and masturbating to it, and just burning myself out to the point where I was just so disgusted.
To Daniel, it felt like an addiction, and some other kind of binge would follow the masturbation. Weed, a roll of cookie dough. He started gaining weight, and that spooked him. This was a few years ago. He remembered NoFap, the day counter on his brother's phone, and he came across all these claims on social media, on YouTube.
Goodbye, brain fog. Say hello to an increase in memory and cognitive function.
More charismatic when you're on the NoFap journey. That's one of the superpowers or the benefits you get from being
increased levels of motivation, increased energy levels. And increased
Daniel
confidence.
Was sold.
I had immersed myself so much in the community. I'm like, I think this is real. You hear about these stories of guys getting all these benefits. Their lives just turning around.
It was easy at first, but week after week, he says he started hearing two voices in his head. One wanted to quit and another didn't.
Like, my brain was trying to find every single possibility, every trick in the book, every justification I could make. Like, all of the characteristics and traits of an addiction, like, I was going through it.
It became a struggle.
I can't count the amount of times I messed up and how many relapses I made. It was just like, you know, I do great, then I do horrible, and then I do a little better and horrible, horrible, horrible.
At the same time he started NoFap, Daniel also started working out, trying to eat better. He says things improved. He met his first ever girlfriend.
I had never kissed a girl. before then. I had never kissed a girl, never. Yeah, I was literally like only kissed by a girl, and that's my mother on my forehead.
NoFap didn't give him superpowers, but Daniel says he's happier than he's ever been, more self-assured.
I felt more free. I'd be in social scenarios, and I would lead things more. I would take more initiative. I cared less about, you know, whether that guy thinks a bit of my fat is leaking out of my shirt.
I reached out to a Johns Hopkins urologist, Amin Harati, to get his take on all of this. He says, first off, you need periodic arousal. Those erections men get basically out of nowhere, they actually keep your penis healthy.
Men have a use it or lose it phenomenon, which means that in the absence of regularly occurring erections and in the absence of oxygen nutrient-rich blood being delivered to the penis, the smooth muscle of the penis can get replaced by fibrotic tissue.
That's tissue that doesn't expand well, causing erectile dysfunctions. Masturbation often naturally just follows that arousal. Physiologically, hormonally, Amin says nothing changes when you stop masturbating for really long periods of time. But he did say a short break, say a couple days, could be good for guys who really overdo it. I also reached out to a sex therapist, Marty Klein. He says, if you think about masturbation as an addiction, you're going to struggle because it's literally always at your fingertips. He also says it means missing out on something wonderful.
People need to reaffirm the value of masturbation. It's a vehicle for self-discovery. It's a way of learning how to self-soothe, and it's just part of growing up and being an adult who is in charge of their own sexuality.
If you think your masturbation is a problem, Marty says look to a physician or a psychologist, not a message board. So I ask Daniel, did you think about seeing any kind of healthcare professional?
Honestly, not once. Like, I never considered it at all.
He thought he'd just get laughed at.
But at the same time, I was reading up a lot of posts on Reddit, and these guys were like, I went to my therapist, and this guy just thinks, like, this NoFap stuff is a joke.
Daniel told me he had masturbated a few days before we spoke. It was his first time in many months, and he called it a relapse. I tell him what Marty told me, the stuff about being in charge of your own sexuality. He said that actually made sense to him.
Yeah, it's like, your penis is attached to you. You don't want to have a negative relationship with that, you know?
He's quit again, but he says he doesn't want to never masturbate again. For now, he says NoFap makes him feel good, and he's not hurting anybody, so he's going to keep doing it.
That's Jed Slayman reporting. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about sex and how it affects our health. Sex is connected to biological urges, to desire. And we just heard about people who want to get a handle on those urges and feel more in charge. But for other people, that urge, that desire, is pretty much absent. Paulus Van Horn has more.
Sex, the oldest of human drives. But some of us don't have that drive. Or have one that works a little bit differently, like mine. It makes me feel like an alien, like the only one from my species, dropped here on planet Earth, trying to manage the expectations of human sexuality. Those expectations that you have sex, want sex, are regularly sexual, they're everywhere.
So let's get some sex topics in here. So a survey posted in Psychology Today wanted to find out why people fantasize about sex. And the answers range from, you know, duh, sexual arousal.
My friend Helen Hee feels this pressure around sex as well.
Hi, I'm Helen.
Among many things, Helen is asexual. But in practice, what does that mean?
A person who's asexual is identified as someone who does not experience sexual attraction. Think of like someone who's straight, so they're not into someone who's the same gender with them. Me, I'm just not into someone who's like any gender, you know? It's just like, as a human being, like as a functional member of the society, I feel like the society just like expects you to like have sex if you're like in a relationship and like in love. And a lot of times I feel like like I shouldn't go against that. Like I don't want to like make the other person like sad or anything like that.
Wanting sex is just normal, right? A healthy relationship can only be one with a lot of sex. That's the message we get anyway.
Yeah, I feel like there are definitely a lot of times that I just like have sex and I don't really think about if I want it or not. I just like have it and then I just like cry afterwards because I just felt really, really bad and like dirty and used and just like this is not something I wanted.
Helen is constantly explaining that they use they-them pronouns or about their asexuality. And they've tried all sorts of poetic metaphors to convey their experience to others.
Let's say I'm not really into, like...
But this metaphor, I think, worked the best.
Clam chowder. I have a partner whom I love, who's super into clam chowder. And sometimes I just like to make it for him. And then, like, I like to have it with him and... Even if I'm not, like, super into the flavor or anything like that, it just, like, it makes me feel happy and content because I'm doing something nice with, like, someone I love, you know?
Getting what we need is more important than having sex. We're all just trying to figure out how to be happy in our bodies and what those bodies need.
There's hope! We're happy! I'm happy, you know? Yeah.
That story was reported by Paulus Van Horn. We often talk about sex as a healthy part of life, something to enjoy. But what if the sex you want to have is impossible or painful? Noah Fleischacker has been living with that reality for years.
I'm 27 years old, and I've never had penetrative sex. I've tried, but every time I'd feel this intense, stinging, and searing pain. Kind of like if you were doing the splits, and someone was pushing you into a much, much deeper stretch than feels possible for your body. I'm from Chicago, but these days I live in Jerusalem. I've seen 11 healthcare professionals in the last year and a half, and I've been waiting for 6 months to see the 12th, gynecologist Ahinoam Lev-Sagi. She specializes in vulvar pain conditions and basically has women all around Israel calling her.
Ooh, it's called V Clinic. I wonder what the V stands for.
She sits across from me as if we're two equals in a meeting. She speaks quietly and looks me in the eye. She asks about my symptoms.
I'm not in pain unless there's any kind of penetration, like tampon, penetrative sex.
It's the usual questions. Are you taking any medications? Can you tell me about your medical history? She's trying to rule out other health conditions that could be causing my pain. She guesses right that I first noticed the problem while trying to insert a tampon.
Pain was when you tried to insert a tampon or?
I was never able to put in a tampon, so I think it was then. It didn't become like something that I realized was kind of like not gonna go away until I kept trying to get a pap smear and they just couldn't do it.
By this point, I'm a pro at going to the doctor. I've got a notebook where I've listed everything I've tried so far. Back in Chicago, I tried muscle relaxants, Valium you insert into your vagina, antidepressants for pain, and I saw a psychiatrist who gave me anti-anxiety meds. But there isn't a whole lot of research to back up any of these medications. I went to my primary care physician, my gynecologist. They weren't particularly concerned. They basically told me to relax. Next, I went to two pelvic health specialists who directed me to a physical therapist. Over the course of 8 months, she helped me stretch and release my pelvic floor muscles. And at home, for an hour every night, I used dilators, which are medical tools that let me practice on my own. And almost nothing I tried was covered, so I fought with my health insurance company a lot. Frustrated and angry, I recorded voice memos to keep track of it all.
When I went to my new physical therapist for the first time, she even at one point like acknowledged, like she was like, wow, you've been doing a lot of work on this like for 5 months and nothing's changed. And I just like burst into tears because I was like, yes, thank you for recognizing that I've been doing painful things to myself for 5 months and it's not changing.
Still, after every appointment, I was hopeful that I was improving. Here's another voice memo from a year ago.
last week I was like, oh my God, it's over. Like, I can have all the sex and babies and be done. And then this week was like, it's never going to go away. It's going to be the rest of my life. Like, I'm going to be in pain forever.
For years, I kept the pain to myself. When I finally started telling people, some of their comments made me uncomfortable.
Are you still going to date men?
Is your boyfriend okay with that?
Wow, your boyfriend must be so amazing.
People acted like he was some kind of superhero for not leaving me. Sharon Orshalemi is a sexual health educator and runs an awareness group for women. She says, for heterosexual women, experiencing pain with sex can threaten your personal identity.
As a woman, as a sexual being, as a sexual partner and a love partner, not just sexual partner.
About 1 in 5 women in the U.S. have a chronic vulvar pain condition, which is to say, it's pretty common. But there isn't a lot of consensus on the treatments that work. Many women are told, go home, drink a glass of wine. Sharon says pelvic pain is political. She's critical of the conventional thinking, which goes something like this.
Penetration is the core of heterosexual sex and heterosexual femininity and whatever. And there's actually no choice when you do heterosexual sex if you do intercourse or not. There's no choice because it's the definition of sex and it's the obvious.
For me, that's never been true. My boyfriend and I do have great sex, but just not penetrative sex. His name is Bar Blass, and we've been together for 3 years. It isn't a big deal for either of us, but we still haven't totally accepted the fact that we don't have intercourse.
Wow, this is scary recording this conversation.
Bar let me tape us one night while we sat on our bed, but he's not a big talker.
I hope that we can figure it out one day, but not worried about that so much today.
Are you saying, like, you hope one day we can have penetrative sex?
Yeah.
What if we can't?
That's what I talked about a few days ago also.
What if I decide not from a place of not caring, but from a place of I don't want to keep doing painful physical therapy and spending huge amounts of money on this. And I don't know that it's worth it. What do you think about that?
Maybe there's something else to try.
But my doctors at home in Chicago were out of ideas, which is why I'm sitting across from Israel's vulvar pain expert, Achinoam Lev-Sagi.
Hi.
The appointment with her was different. Even before asking me to undress, she talked me through some of the conditions that can cause painful penetration. Sometimes the pain is a side effect of birth control. If you use the pill over a long period of time, it can change your hormone levels and cause the skin to thin out. But I was only on the pill for a short time, so the doctor ruled that out. Achinoam also talked about pelvic muscle spasms, which can also cause pain. Another possibility is pain caused by the hymen. That's the thin membrane of tissue that can partially cover the opening to the vagina.
That might be very, very painful. And I missed it for too many years, and I no longer miss it.
After explaining the conditions, she does a particular physical exam that none of my other doctors had done.
Okay.
Using a small Q-tip, she touches various points along the vestibule, or the opening of my vagina, to determine where the pain is. She starts at the top. It doesn't hurt. If you imagine the vestibule as a clock, when she gets to 4, 6, and 8 o'clock, it's really painful. And when she inserts her finger, I start crying. She's identified where the most extreme pain is, which means she knows what might be causing it.
This is the worst pain. So you don't have stability, you have a very thick hymen.
It's hard to hear, but that's me laugh crying because a doctor is finally telling me what I believed all along. There's something inside of me that needs to come out. I have an abnormally thick and rigid hymen, and my muscle dysfunction, the spasms, the pain are probably related to this. There's a surgery I can get to remove my hymen, and that's a relief. But best of all, the doctor says, for now, Don't even think about trying to have penetrative sex. It won't work. Honestly, it's so good to hear that, especially from a doctor. Maybe at some point I'll be able to. But in the meantime, Bar and I are going to keep doing what we're doing.
That's Noah Fleischacker. She produced this piece together with Hannah Bark, and they launched a podcast called Tight-Lipped. There's a link on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. We were just listening to this story about sex being a painful experience physically, but what we probably hear more often about is sex being painful emotionally, usually because of a history of sexual abuse or trauma. Writer and activist Adrienne Marie Brown says past sexual traumas can mean that you get triggered during intimate moments with a partner.
Often that shuts us down or we go silent. We don't tell the person what's happening. Being able to slow down, being able to stop what's happening in the moment and knowing that you have the right to do that at any time, to be like, this doesn't feel safe right now at any time.
Adrienne discusses dealing with trauma and triggers in her book, Pleasure Activism. And she says that part, speaking up when something doesn't feel right, is really important.
And to begin to reclaim agency over what happens in the realm of sex. Because for so many of us, that's the first thing that gets taken from us is any sense of agency. It's like, well, sex is happening to me, or this person wants this, and so I give that. And instead of, you know, sex doesn't just happen to you. Sex is something that you choose to share in with another person.
In her work on sex and sexual health, Adrienne focuses on women of color. I asked her how she understands the relationship between sex and health in a broader sense.
I think when you are fully healthy, sex is just a natural and easy part of life. It's a way to connect with others. It's a way to feel your own body. As health gets compromised, and it gets compromised by many things, a lot of that is trauma and socialization. There's ways that we begin to think that sex is something that we're only doing to please someone else, or something that is only seen as terrifying. You know, I often think about how I was socialized around sex to be very cautious of it as an extremely dangerous activity physically, but not to be cautious about it necessarily emotionally.
Yeah, I mean, some of the first things I remember ever hearing about sex is that you can get pregnant or you can get really, really sick.
Yes.
Having sex. That's a big message. Yeah.
It's a big message. And, you know, it's true. You know, the time when we were growing up, for me, I'm 40. Mm-hmm. And so the time that I was growing up was, you know, the pregnancy piece was a really big deal. But then there was HIV and people not knowing anything about it. I feel like we get so many mixed messages around sex, and so much of it is about other people. And a lot of what I try to do is say, start with your own body, start with your own feelings. For me, I started feeling sexual feelings when I was very young. And I think it's really important to protect that innocent exploration of the body, that innocent getting to know the body and understanding it as a place of pleasure that has nothing to do with anyone else's wants or desires or needs.
Why do you think it's so important to especially talk to women of color about sex and pleasure?
Yeah, I really feel like we as Black women, as women of color in this country, have served such a role of service for such a long time. Our bodies were used to bear children. Our bodies were used to nurse children. Our bodies were used sexually whenever a master wanted to use them. Our bodies were fetishized and continue to be fetishized as bodies that are sexual as a taboo. So I think, you know, swimming inside of all those waters to try to get back to the root system in which our bodies are, you know, like all human bodies, places of miraculous pleasure, places of longing and desire, places where we can feel intuition and feel longing. It's trying to reclaim our bodies for what they actually are. And I love working with women of color around these things and watching them light up, because for most of us, we're feeling already so much inside and just not sure what to do with it.
I think girls and women don't learn a lot about pleasure and sex, and
right.
It's more a narrative of power often, of giving something up or not giving something up, yes. and control. Yeah. How can we change that narrative for women to be interested in pleasure and to think about, what would I like here?
Yeah. I mean, I'm really interested in there being many pathways to this. So I love the pop culture trends towards pole dancing and towards all these women who are like, wait, I, no matter how old I am and no matter what I was told about strippers and stripteasing and all of that, it actually brings me pleasure to learn how to dance on this pole and learn how to twerk my body just for me and just in a class full of other women. And then in personal relationships, I think it's really important to talk about sex. So that's one of the things that I think, like, if the majority of people were to pick one practice that they were to engage in that could really shift this, I would say it's starting to have more open-ended conversations about sex. Conversations that are not just, there's a crisis, you know, there's something going wrong, but conversations that are like, here's something that's really going right, or here's something I'm really longing for and I don't know how to get.
You often give your readers homework.
Yes.
Little assignments, yeah, that they should try or do. Give me an example of something like that.
Let's see. There's a whole article about getting naked, looking at yourself naked, really starting to find something that you appreciate about your body. I'm blown away by the number of people who have no idea what their bodies look like, and then struggle to get undressed in front of other people because I'm like, yeah, it's, you have no idea how beautiful you are and how desirable you are, and you should know that about yourself. You should look at yourself.
Adrienne Marie Brown is a writer and Black feminist. Her book is called Pleasure Activism: The Politics of Feeling Good. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, Jad Slayman, and Steph Yin. Julian Harris is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. Tanya English is our editorial director. I'm Maiken Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated health care.
WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.